This episode of She Explores is brought to you by Merrill. Merrill exists to give you all you really need to discover the simple yet profound power of the trail. They believe the trail is for everybody and everybody. Merrill's goal is to provide thoughtfully designed, rigorously tested products that over-deliver on performance, versatility, and durability. Because when you've got air in your lungs and good shoes on your feet, you've got everything you need. My first pair of Merrells were trail runners that I bought to explore the old rail beds of New Hampshire that have turned into bike paths. I now have a new pair, the Women's Antora Trail Runners. They're lightweight, but they have a really nice stable footbed, which works well with me and my high arches. I really enjoy the freedom they give me to explore the winding paths near my home. Stay tuned for more stories with Merrell this summer, and to learn more in the meantime, visit Merrell.com. That's Merrell.com. Before we totally get started this week, I wanted to share a bit of a personal disappointment on my end. I was planning on leaving Saturday for an 8-day backpacking trip in the Washington Cascades with a really good friend, and my partner broke his ankle yesterday, water skiing, and he might need surgery, and he needs me. And I'm really working on trying to grapple with that balance, like balance that feeling of disappointment and also, you know, wanting to help out my partner. So if anyone's been there too, feel free to drop me a line on Instagram. I'd really appreciate it. I'm Gail Straub, and you're listening to She Explores.
I had the most wonderful release last year where the bird flew up and like landed on top of a saguaro with the full moon behind it.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it was a great horned owl just standing up there. And it was one that I'd worked with for a long time that had been really injured. And it was just, it's so great. It's so great to see that. And it's worth all of the time that all of these volunteers put in. Because it's not, you know, it obviously it's not just me. There's a whole shift, two shifts a week full of people like me that are doing everything that they can to make these animals go back into the wild. And so to see that culmination and to see it go back and stand on top of a saguaro and use its wings to get up there, and it's just incredible.
Wildlife rehabilitation makes it possible for animals to get a second chance. Serena Rana Dufault is the writer, photographer, and hiker behind Trails Inspire, a consultancy that connects trails and communities. I guess you could call that her day job. We talked all about that in an earlier episode of this podcast, which I'll link in the show notes. But this week, I wanted to learn more about Serena's volunteer work at Wildlife Rehabilitation in Northwest Tucson. Over the years, I've heard bits and pieces about wildlife rehab, but I've always wanted to learn more. Like, how do you know when you need to call an animal in? What happens once those animals get there? And why is wildlife rehab needed in the first place? Serena started volunteering 10 years ago when her curiosity was piqued by a small injured bird.
I found a bird in my yard. It was a small songbird, a finch, and it was injured. And so I went online and decided to find out, you know, what to do with this bird, and was directed to Wildlife Rehabilitation Northwest Tucson. And I called and I brought the bird in. I didn't know anything about rehabilitation or birds or anything about it. And when I was dropping the bird off, I was pretty interested in what went on there. I asked one of the women that was volunteering if I could have a tour. I remember it was just amazing to be able to see these, you know, they had small songbirds in one area, but then they had these enclosures outside with larger hawks and owls and things like that. And I remember asking about what exactly it was that they did when they were volunteering there, because, you know, a lot of what I'd seen people doing when I was dropping the bird off was cleaning cages. And so I was like, what is it that you guys exactly do here? And it was so interesting to me It was right at the time when I had just finished hiking the Arizona Trail in sections, and that had been a pretty big project for me. It had taken up a lot of time, and I just finished, and I was looking for something new to take up that time because I knew that there was going to be a big hole in my schedule, and I wanted to fill it with something interesting and fun. I bought the bird in a couple of months before I was done with the trail, so when I finished, I went and inquired about what it took to volunteer.
You know, like I said before, you could think, why do we need wildlife rehab? Aren't the animals wild? Isn't death and injury a part of the circle of life? Well, as Serena explains, we humans get in the way.
These birds and mammals, they've existed their whole lives without mankind and cars and windows and things like that, things that can hurt them, artificial things. And so this is why you have birds flying into your windows, because they don't understand that's not a part of the natural world. And so because of these things, because there are electrocutions and there are animals getting hit by vehicles, that's part of the reason for wildlife rehab. Also, there's the injury part of wildlife rehab, and then there's also the babies part of wildlife rehab. Once baby season happens in the spring, you can have animals whose parents have been killed and the babies don't have anybody to raise them, and so they come to us. Or ones that can't quite fly yet, they become isolated from their parents, they need to come to us. Things of that nature. And so this is why we have this wildlife rehabilitation at all. And most places will have a rehabilitation center.
Serena volunteers at a center that focuses on birds and small mammals.
So the place that I'm at, it's Wildlife Rehabilitation in Northwest Tucson, and it was started by Janet and Lewis Miller back in 1985. And they had their careers, and then they decided that this is what they wanted to do when they retired. So they did an apprenticeship for 6 months, and the facility is actually at their home. And Lewis passed away in 2010, and so now it's Janet that takes care of the wildlife rehab. But it's a huge job. Janet is completely self-supported, and it's not a nonprofit. It's a complete, this comes right out of Janet's pocket. And so she has dedicated her life to these animals, and it's really something to see. She is one of my absolute heroes. She's so knowledgeable and just passionate about this work.
So what was it like when you first got started volunteering? What were some of your first tasks?
First of all, you can't just drop in and volunteer. It requires a time commitment, and you need to be able to be available for one shift a week at least. And the shifts are generally, depending on how busy we are with animals, they can be anywhere from like 4 to 6 hours. I volunteer on Monday mornings, and I started out with everybody starts out with songbirds and bunnies because basically they're the easiest ones, and also they're the least dangerous to work with. You know, if you get bit by a tiny songbird, it's not going to hurt. And so you start out feeding songbirds, and they're fed generally, if they come in as babies, they're fed like with syringes with food. And you learn the proper way to, you don't just feed, you have to put the syringe down the throat because it can aspirate the food otherwise, and it can kill the bird if you don't feed it properly. So even, with these small birds, there's definitely still things to learn and how to handle them and, making sure how to open the cages and feed them without them flying out of them, things like that. And that's what you start out with.
So Serena started with small birds and worked her way up to small mammals. They all sound adorable.
We have bunnies, we have squirrels. On the smaller side of things, we have skunks a lot of times. They're really cute. We have sometimes javelina, which are like a small, they kind of look like a wild pig, but they're related to peccaries. They're a desert animal. I have to mention, I'm in the Southwest, so we have some animals that you don't might not find other places. But lots of bunnies starting in the spring. And Janet Miller, who runs the facility, she's kind of a bunny specialist. We also have a lot of jackrabbits that come in. Those are really special as well.
How long did it take you to move to the larger of the smaller mammals and the larger birds of prey?
Well, as I was volunteering there, I became interested in working with the birds of prey. We have everything from small falcons like kestrels to hawks, red-tailed hawks. We have peregrine falcons sometimes, lots of great horned owls, different kinds of owls. And I was just really fascinated by the larger birds. First of all, just because it's so special to be able to see them up close. When you see a hawk or something like that, it's usually far off in the distance and soaring above you. And to be able to be up close and personal and helping and feeding these things and helping them to regain their strength so that they can be released back into the wild, that was something that really interested me. And so it was a process. It's you learn everything by doing. And so you find somebody that will help take you under their wing, so to speak. And they can show you how to handle the raptors, how to feed them, first safety concerns and all of those things. And that's just something that you learn by doing. And I have to admit, it is terrifying at first. And it's still scary. I mean, I still have days there where it's scary, but especially when you're first learning and you're not sure of yourself, it's pretty intimidating, but super rewarding.
What's scary about it? That was actually, thinking about even just skunks like that could be, it seems scary.
Yeah, you want to talk scary. I've gone on a skunk release where we drove them like for 2.5 hours in this car, just hoping that like these four skunks wouldn't go off.
Thankfully, they didn't. But there are other dangers.
But with the large birds, it depends on who you're working with, but all of them have giant talons. The great horned owl has one of the largest grip strengths in all of the animal kingdom, I think. And so it and these talons, they're huge. They're like 2 inches long, some of them, and they're like feet full of knives, basically. Then the beaks are very, very dangerous. They can bite if you get too close. As careful as you try and be, sometimes things happen. I've had been taloned on a number of occasions. And it's scary, and it's also generally a puncture wound, which is really dangerous. It can get infected really easily. So just trying to use the utmost caution and not, become too comfortable where you're letting your guard down is really important. But then also where you're dealing with a wild animal, sometimes a wild animal that's injured and not in a great mood, and you're trying to manipulate this bird and, it's pretty dangerous. But like I said, you just try and do the best you can to stay safe. And the reward is definitely worth it, working with these animals. And you're just reminded every single day that these are wild animals. This is not somebody's pet, as cute as they might be or whatever. This is a wild animal and it needs to be treated as such.
Not a lot of people get up close, like you said, and to be able to kind of learn that lesson over and over again, it's pretty valuable.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking like up close, like I have to catch great horned owls by their legs on a regular basis.
What?
Like, let me explain to you what we do. So I do a lot of the flying before the animals are released. So once they get to a certain point, let's say they've come in and they've had an injury, they've been rehabilitated, and now we want to see how their flight is going. So I do a lot of the test flights. And we'll take the bird out to it's like a park where they do the model airplanes. So we'll take them to this facility, which is just down the road, but we don't take the bird in a cage. because it's dangerous, because you don't want to be putting it in a cage and worrying about its feathers. So I'll catch the bird. Then we have to put what's called jesses on the bird. So that's basically like little anklets that snap onto the ankles of the bird. So while I'm holding the bird, somebody else has to take their hands and get really close to this talon, you know, with gloves on, but get close to this talon to put these anklets on. Then we get the anklets on the bird, snapped on the bird, and then I hold the bird in my hand in the car.
Wow.
While we're going to the place. And that is, to me, the scariest part of it, because can you imagine if a wild bird got loose in the car?
Oh my gosh.
There was actually a story last year of a woman who had picked up a great horned owl who was stunned, and it came to in her car and slashed terribly. So here we are, we're driving over to the, you know, the flight area. I've got this bird in my hand, and then we take it out, we fly it, recapture it, and then do the same thing on the way back. And so it's not like I'm just putting the food in a container or in a flight cage. Like I'm up close and personal with these guys. And, you know, when they come in, when they're injured, a lot of times we'll have to catch them and feed them because they don't know how to feed them on their own. Like a lot of times they'll come in with head injuries and they've lost the ability to feed themselves. And so we'll have to catch them and feed them. And so I'm very up close and personal with some big talons and scary beaks, but like I said, it's an incredible thing to see so close and to be a part of that rehabilitation.
Would you say it's in your opinion, a human responsibility to take care of these animals because of the impact that we have on their environments?
Absolutely. I mean, we're the ones that put these obstacles there.
We'll hear more from Serena after this. Women deserve an effective multivitamin they can trust. When Kat Schneider realized that this didn't exist, she decided to create her own and founded Ritual. Ritual is the obsessively researched multivitamin designed for and by women. It contains 9 nutrients that are difficult to get enough of every day, even with a healthy diet, including vitamin E, vegan omega-3 from algae, iron, magnesium, folate, vitamin K2, and vitamin B12. Instead of taking a handful of 5 to 8 vitamins, Ritual makes it easy with just 2 capsules a day. You can order online at ritual.com for around $1 a day. Ritual is delivered to your door monthly, so you can stay on track. And unlike other multivitamins, Ritual's capsules have a no-nausea design, so they're gentle on an empty stomach. They even include a mint tab in every bottle to help mask any fishy aftertaste. I made Ritual part of my daily ritual a year ago and have benefited from peace of mind while traveling, knowing I've got all the gaps in my diet covered. Try Ritual today, and you'll get an exclusive offer for 10% off your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/explore to start your ritual today. That's 10% off your first 3 months at ritual.com/explore. We're back. What do you do when you find a wild animal? What's the process like?
So a lot of times people will call and they are admittedly, with good reason, scared of these animals. So they'll call us and they'll just be, you know, tell us there's an owl in the yard. So we either go one person or we can double up if the person doesn't feel comfortable. And you go and you never know. You never know what it's going to be like. You don't know if the bird's going to be injured. You don't know if the bird's, what's happened to it. You don't know if it's angry. You don't know if it's docile. And so you just kind of go in completely prepared. I wear big gloves that come all the way up almost to my armpit, carry a net, and hopefully, you know, you can capture it and get it in a carrier. I will tell you about one of the worst times I ever had to do that.
Yeah.
Was a turkey vulture capture.
Those are big.
Not only are they big, they have a defense mechanism, and it is to throw up on you.
Oh, no. Oh, and they're scavengers too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. It's basically like the absolute worst smell I've ever smelled in my whole life. This rescue was years ago, probably like 8 years ago. I'm still, you know, tormented by the thought of that smell. So hopefully you're not capturing a turkey vulture, and with whatever it is, you get it into the cage. And generally, I like to cover the cage with a towel just to cut down on the stimulus from outside, because it's pretty stressful for the bird to be caught. Then it goes back to the facility, and we take it out of the cage and give it a really good look to make sure that it's not injured. Spreading the wings and just checking the legs and giving it a good once over to make sure that, you know, we're seeing what the condition of the animal is. And then it'll be fed and given water, because a lot of times these animals will have been out there for a little while before they're able to be caught. And so we'll give them water and food and then put them in a smaller cage inside. So almost everything starts out in a small cage inside for observation. And so we can make sure that it's okay to be put into one of the larger flight cages. And so it's a progression, let's say for, you know, an owl, it would be a progression from like seeing what it looks like inside, then you'll take it out to flap. So you take the bird out and you take it outside and let it get some exercise with its wings. If it's injured, one thing that's been really interesting is that sometimes I'm required to do physical therapy on these birds. And I used to be a massage therapist in another life. And so I never thought that I would be using my massage therapy skills on, you know, a peregrine falcon or a great horned owl, but it's pretty neat. So you do little exercises, you know, let's say they came in with a broken wing and it's been set and cast and now you're doing rehab with it. You'll do little stretching exercises and to give it the mobility that it needs to get back into the air.
At this point, I'm starting to think, birds, they're just like us. Next up is a flight cage, a large cage that the bird can fly in and be observed by volunteers.
If it looks like it's coming along well, then that's when you'd take it out to do a test flight. You'd also test to see if it can kill live prey. And so only after it's been rehabbed, then given a test flight, then made sure that, you know, it can kill on its own, and then it's considered an option for release. With all of these animals, you want to make sure that you're releasing them at the proper time. You don't want to release an owl that's a night animal in the morning. You know, it'll be confused and tired. So those get released closer to dusk. Also, taking into account what kind of weather we're having here in Tucson, it tends to get pretty hot. And it also gets pretty cold in the wintertime too. We have pretty cold winter nights. And so protecting them from any kind of inclement weather, at least in the days right after its release. And so once all of that is set, we'll either look at where the bird originally came from and release it back there. Or if for some reason that is not feasible, we'll choose another location. And that's based on a number of different things. A lot of times, though, it's nice to be a little bit farther outside of town. I like areas that have a lot of horses. There's usually a lot of prey animals there for the birds to feed on. I'm lucky enough to have been able to do a lot of these releases. And I have to tell you, it is just one of the most magical things you've ever seen in your whole life. Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, having been involved with whatever animal it is for however many weeks it's been there. I've been feeding it. I've been, you know, maybe taking it out for a test flight. And now it's, you know, I always tell them, it's your big day, you know. And I get to take them. And, you know, it's funny because you open up the cage and you wish that, you know, every time you're like, okay, I'm going to open up the cage and it's going to burst out, you know, majestically and return to the wild. But sometimes, no matter how excited the birds are when you're in the in the car transporting them or whatever in the carrier, a lot of times you'll get to the spot and you open up the cage and they just sit there. They just sit in the cage and they look at you and they're like, "What am I supposed to be doing?" And so sometimes they need a little bit of a nudge to get out of the cage. But to see them like take off and fly off, I had the most wonderful release last year where the bird flew up and like landed on top of a saguaro with the full moon behind it.
Oh, wow.
It was a great horned owl just standing up there, and it was one that I'd worked with for a long time that had been really injured. And it was just, it's so great. It's so great to see that. And it's worth all of the time that all of these volunteers put in. Because it's not, obviously, it's not just me. There's a whole shift, two shifts a week full of people like me that are doing everything that they can to make these animals go back into the wild. And so to see that culmination and to see it go back and stand on top of a saguaro and use its wings to get up there, and it's just incredible.
We kind of talked about the life cycle of when you take a bird in. What are some examples of when you actually would leave an animal in the wild rather than taking it in?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different reasons that you would leave something in the wild. I'll give a couple examples. So, for example, baby bunnies. The reason that we get so many baby bunnies in is because people a lot of times mistakenly think that they've been abandoned. But if you learn about how bunnies treat their babies, then you can get a better understanding of why you might see just some bunnies sitting out in the grass by themselves. So, desert cottontail rabbits here, they will leave their babies for most of the day to go and hunt. It's actually not good for them to be near their babies because they will attract attention to them. And so in a lot of animal species, the babies are left during the day. And sometimes humans, thinking, that they want to help, will say, "Oh, this is an abandoned animal. I need to grab it and take it to the wildlife rehab." But really, it's just that the mom is out, the parents are out, they're getting food and they're doing their thing, and they'll be back. Now, if you've seen a clutch of babies and you haven't seen any activity or bunnies or anything like that for, days and days, maybe. But a lot of times people, they mean well, but they scoop up these babies and now instead of growing up with their parents, they're growing up in a wildlife rehab and being released. Another example would be quail. We get a lot of quail babies. And it's because the quail, once the chicks are a certain size, the quail will move on. They'll hatch the babies, but then quail do not sit in one space for a long time. That's a great way to get eaten if you're a quail. And so they're always on the move. And if those babies can't keep up or they can't follow, then they get left behind. So a lot of times what will happen is the quail will lay their eggs in like a raised planter pot. The babies will be born, but then the adults will jump out of the pot, leaving the babies to follow, but they can't follow because it's too high up for them. And so the quail will wait around for a little bit, but after a while they have to leave. And so then they'll abandon the chicks. A good way to help that is if you do see a bunch of quail without a mom, is to maybe tip the pot over so that they can get out for a couple of days and see if that helps. And if the parents come and they can whisk them away and then they can follow, but it's just that the quail can't physically get out of that enclosure.
Overall, it's so important to remember what's best for the animals, and sometimes that means keeping them right where they are. Serena, fill me in on another misconception, a myth that we've created about baby birds.
I don't know where this idea started that, everybody's heard if you touch a baby animal, its mother will reject it. And the weirdest thing is that's not true, but it seems to be such a universally held idea You know, everybody heard that growing up. Oh, don't touch, you know, and you wonder, like, did somebody just make that up so that kids wouldn't touch a bunch of babies? You know, or what? Like, how did that happen? But we see all of the time where you can actually, a lot of times, just go and put the animal back. We see this with birds a lot. When the birds are fledgling and they don't quite know how to fly yet, but they're trying to get out of the nest, sometimes they fall. And so you can actually take a bird that's fallen out of its nest and put it back, and its mom won't reject it. And so, you know, that can also save a lot of people and animals time and energy.
What if you came across an animal and it was like, it had flown into a window or hit by a car and it was close enough to passing away that, like, what do you do in that instance where you feel like it might be close to death?
I still call.
Yeah.
You know, it's just good for them to make the decision. Also, it's good to just let the authorities know, because everything's controlled. All of the wildlife rehabilitation are controlled by Arizona Game and Fish here. And so you can't actually, like, just pick up that bird because of the law. It's also the same law that, you know, says that you can't have wild raptor feathers or any kind of wild feathers. And so it's best that you just call the, you know, somebody that can take care of that.
You said you'd be willing to talk about some of the hard parts of volunteer work. I know we talked about how it can be scary, but what about when it can be sad, like when you actually have to put down an animal?
It happens, and it is definitely a very real part of wildlife rehab, and not one that I talk about. You know, I post a lot of photos and talk about my volunteer work there, but I don't really touch on that very often, partially because it's pretty hard for me. Even though, you know, you try to be detached and stuff, you get attached to these animals, and just the time and the effort that you've spent, and knowing that it just wasn't in the cards for it. You know, it's like we did everything that you could. And at least that's definitely comforting, that when a bird is euthanized, we know that we have done every single thing that we can to try and help that bird or animal. We have several vets that donate their services, and, you know, we're very grateful to them. And so we know that when that step is taken, that it's something that had to be done. But especially when you've worked with an animal for a long time and it's just not getting better, it's pretty tough.
So not getting better might be that it had such a traumatic brain injury that it's never able to fend for itself, like never able to feed itself in the wild.
Right. And so either it's not able to feed itself, or maybe it has a break that's in an area that's not going to heal properly where it can fly again. With some injuries, we haven't really talked about this, but we do have a couple of animals that cannot be released that are educational animals. We're required to do a certain amount of education along with the licensing for Game and Fish for the wildlife rehab. And so we do have a Harris hawk named Satan and a great horned owl named Ollie that are educational animals. And so we'll take those to, you know, school events or events around Tucson, all sorts of different educational programs for people to be up close and personal with these animals. So sometimes you can have a bird that's not releasable, but placeable. So even if it's not with us, there are always places around the country that are looking for, especially southwestern birds, a lot of times are, you know, they're more unusual. Sometimes if a bird can't be released, might not have to be euthanized because we can transfer it to another facility and have it be one of their educational animals. We had this raven a couple of years ago, and we called him Stumpy because he only had one leg. And he was just a character. And he got adopted by a group that does Renaissance festivals and things like that. His name is now Edgar, the raven. And it's amazing. He does all sorts of tricks and stuff and, like, puts different colored sticks by different colored blocks. And, you know, he's starting to talk. And so it's really neat to like actually be able to see for once what happens to an animal after it's been placed. I believe it's called Nightwings. They have a Facebook page and they post little photos and videos of Edgar. He's quite famous.
Oh, it's so nice. It's nice to have even though I know you said that sometimes it's the euthanasia can be what's best for the animal. It's nice to hear about a positive,
right,
you know, life that could come after. And the education part's interesting too. I didn't realize that was a requirement, but that's a great way to give back to community too.
And it really, you know, it means so much more for people to be able to see something up close like that rather than just be told about it on a PowerPoint presentation or something, you know, or even bringing like stuffed birds and things like that. It's just not the same. It really is neat to see people's reactions around our educational birds because it's so unusual to be able to see an owl up close or a Harris hawk. And, you know, it really gives people a connection with nature. And I think that's, you know, it's just lacking these days is a real connection with nature and these animals that are all around us.
Yeah, because it gives a, you know, there's a cumulative impact to that you want to do more for conservation or you do more on a daily basis to help protect animals like that. And speaking of, what are some of the things that anyone can do to prevent animals from needing rehab?
Well, putting reflective decals on your windows, if you have like large glass windows and you have found, you know, that you've had birds running into it, that's a great way to avoid that or even to do it preventatively. I think just in general, you know, we stomp through life, not really paying attention to the natural world around us. And that might mean just kind of being more aware. Also, you know, the fact that now, more, you know, more people will know about the fact that you can rehab an animal. I think that a lot of people don't even understand that that's an option. Just knowing that that's a service that's out there for people. But also, you know, if you have any questions about if something should come in or if something should be rehabilitated, to just reach out and, you know, call or find an organization online that you can ask questions to.
What advice do you have for others who want to get involved, who might want to start volunteering? It sounds like it's depending on this facility, it's a pretty significant time commitment. So I'm guessing you should be serious about it.
Yeah, it's not something where you can just kind of pop in every so often when you have some time. There are people and animals relying on you. And for me, it's also about just prioritizing that space for myself. I love volunteering there. And I love the fact that no matter what else is going on in my life, I am there on Monday mornings. And I, you know, travel a ton. I try and schedule my travel around it and things like that when I can. When I can't, you know, they find people to fill my place. But I think that it's worth it. It's so worth the time and the commitment. You know, just give it a try. There's always places that, and, you know, it's so much work that there's always room for more volunteers. I would be really surprised if you called your local wildlife rehabilitation center and they were like, oh no, we're good. And you know, if you can't volunteer time and you can't give that kind of commitment, there are always, you know, ways to donate. And if it's not money, you can donate supplies a lot of times. And so helping in that way is always welcome.
Yeah. Are there any like surprising supplies that are needed?
Well, let's see. It depends on the facility. Lots of, you know, just lots of towels and towels and paper towels and Kleenex. And, you know, we sometimes will get like little baby hats for the birds.
Oh my gosh.
They're pretty cute because we make them into like little nests. And so, you know, just call and find out what kind of things they need. I'm sure that every place would be more than happy to give you a list.
And if you want to help out where Serena volunteers, Wildlife Rehabilitation Northwest Tucson, run by Janet Miller, who's kept the center going well into her 80s, they're in need of cash donations as well as supplies. Anything small will help. I'll list their website in the show notes and on the episode landing page. As a photographer, do you document a lot of these releases?
Yeah, I can't stop taking photos. Like half of my half my phone is like cute animal and bird pictures and videos. And, you know, I'm so lucky to, like I said, to be able to work up close and personal with them and to get the little feathers around an owl's eyes, you know, in your photo and things like that. It's just, it's incredible. And I love the little videos that I make. I watch them all the time because they're just, you know, especially with the babies, they're just adorable. And how lucky am I?
How has volunteering added to your life over the past? I know you've been volunteering for 9 of the last 10 years.
Volunteering has just given me so much. Enriches my life in so many different ways. And part of it is interacting with these animals. Part of it is just forgetting about whatever else is going on in my life and concentrating on what's happening there for that many hours. Part of it is the people I get to volunteer with. And, you know, it doesn't matter what's going on in my life. I'm always happy when I've walked in the door. And it's interesting. It changes every single week. We always have different animals coming in and going out, and you never know what kind of calls you're going to get. And it's just fascinating. I learned so much. I've developed a deeper communication with animals. Just like when I'm out backpacking and I hear an animal, I know, you know, a lot of times I hear a bird. I know not so much songbirds, because there's so many of them. But for the raptors, you know, the other day I was hiking and I heard a call and it was kind of unusual. And I was like, oh, that's a hungry zone-tailed hawk, wow. You know, because I had heard that before. But we haven't had a zone-tailed hawk for years. And so it's neat to still have that kind of wired in my brain of what that sounds like. And so now when I'm hiking, you know, I know exactly what I'm hearing. And that's been really fascinating too, just getting more into being aware of the birds around me. When I started, I knew nothing about birds. I didn't know a sparrow from a hawk. So it's a complete learning curve. And, you know, it's just endlessly fascinating.
Just one last observation for Serena. Serena was hit by a truck in 1997 and had a long recovery. I couldn't help but see a parallel between her experience and all those animals. Just curious, do you feel a special affinity to these animals in any way because of the accident that you were in?
Interesting. That is an interesting idea. Yeah, I mean, I guess I do. You know, I've not really thought about that. But yeah, I mean, I think I do. You know, you can come back from being hit by a car mm-hmm. and go back to the wild again. Yeah, I think I do.
Serena built a website for Wildlife Rehabilitation Northwest Tucson. Visit by heading wrntucson.weebly.com. I hope you'll consider making a small donation. That's wrntucson.weebly.com. Learn more about Serena and her work by heading to trailsinspire.com. Also, we have a bit of a treat for you. Serena created a compilation video of baby animals and bird releases, and we uploaded it to the episode landing page at she-explorers.com. Thank you to Serena for taking the time. Thanks as well to our sponsors, Merrill and Rich Wool. As always, links and codes are listed in the show notes. Learn more about She Explorers by heading to our website, she-explorers.com, and support the show by leaving us a review wherever you listen and joining the She Explorers podcast Facebook group. With over 5,000 members, it's an encouraging place to share your outdoor endeavors, projects, and to connect with previous guests of the show. And if you enjoyed the podcast, I hope you'll share it with a friend. You can find us on social media just by searching She Explorers. Music is by Josh Woodward, Lee Rosevere, and Kay Engel. Until next week, have fun out there.